Well, I told the least to make it short and sweet, and that was. It was short and fat and sassy. the topic today is an important topic, as Elise mentioned, because truly, heart disease is a critical problem, and it doesn't seem like we've really figured it out, certainly not by looking at the statistics. The latest studies are showing that 32%, almost one-third of all women alive will suffer a heart attack or serious cardiovascular disease. 55% of us men will end up succumbing to a heart attack or even dying of a heart attack. Those are staggering statistics, and so we need to do a far better job than we have been in addressing cardiovascular disease if we hope to figure this out in time so that you and I don't have to succumb, don't have to be one of those statistics. So what are the newest strategies? What is the newest data available to us that help guide us, that help change the course, that gives us that new compass setting that will hopefully get us to the point where we need to be? Because where we've been going, the direction we've been heading, has not been working. Heart disease is still the number one killer, not just in the United States, but the world over. Now, what's interesting and what gives us some clues about cardiovascular disease is that historically we have compartmentalized disease into communicable diseases and non-communicable diseases. Diseases that are infectious and diseases that are not. And now, where does cardiovascular disease fit in that historically? Well, we call it one of the main non-communicable. In other words, you can't give it to somebody else. It's something that you basically get on your own. But now we are recognizing that is not actually true. One of the greatest risk factors for cardiovascular disease is now being recognized as subtle infections that are subclinical. They just kind of linger. We are not sick enough to go see the doctor. We don't necessarily feel like we have an infection. And therefore, this subclinical infection festers and festers over many times decades. And that can be a major factor in causing heart disease. Now, today I'm going to try to give you some practical pointers. I'm going to try to outline for you what I consider, based on my reading of the literature and my own experience over the last 25 years of working with patients, is what are the top priorities? Secondarily, I want to give you specific things that you can test or that you can request from your doctor that can be evaluated, blood tests. Many of them will be blood tests that will give you clues, that will give you a whole different understanding of what your risk might be. So oftentimes I see a patient or I might just talk to somebody who says, I don't really have any cardiovascular risk factors. I had my cholesterol checked a few years ago, and it was perfect. Somehow we've gotten this idea that if our cholesterol's good, we don't have risk for heart disease. In other words, the National Cholesterol Education Program that began in the mid-1980s has done a wonderful job. They have educated the entire country to understand that cholesterol is an issue, but actually have caused us to believe that it is the main issue with cardiovascular disease. And what I like to suggest to you today, that's really not true. The latest data, and looking at a study conducted by Dr. David Eddy, who's a professor of medicine at Duke University and now at Stanford University, who carefully analyzed each individual risk factor and mathematically figured out if we just treated that one risk factor in individuals starting in the mid-20s, and fully controlled that through the end of life, how much of an impact would that have on that person's risk of heart disease? And the data that comes from this, what we call the Archimedes mathematical model, it's one of the best models to date looking at risk of disease in the future, is that the LDL cholesterol, that bad cholesterol, that L stands for lousy, right? It's the bad cholesterol, is only associated with about 16%. In other words, if we perfectly controlled LDL, not just to an acceptable range, but to a really low level, right around 100 in everybody, we would only prevent 16% of heart attacks. Okay. So hopefully that suggests to you and I that we need to do more than just control cholesterol. I'm not suggesting we don't need to control cholesterol. We need to expand our perspective. We need to look beyond, because there is hidden risk around many other corners that we haven't maybe paid attention to, because the idea is, hey, I'm on my statin, okay? And that should totally take care of my cardiovascular risk, and that just simply is not the case. Just recently, in fact, today, I was looking at some of the latest studies on cardiovascular health, checking out the various medical journals and the latest studies that are being actually discussed for the first time at medical conferences around the country over the last few weeks. I came across an email from my friend Joe. And Joe seems to send out profound emails. And so I thought, I'll just click on that. And it was a little video, about a minute and 50 seconds long, called The Power of Words. The video starts out in what appears to be a Wall Street area, a very ritzy area, classy stone buildings, and there's an old man sitting on a 3x4 cardboard with a little tin can in front, and occasionally somebody drops a coin. Pretty soon you see this busy, fast-paced executive businesswoman walking, and she doesn't slow down until she passes the sign that this blind man is holding. She stops, comes back, picks up the sign, turns it around. She notices that the sign says, "I am blind, please help." She turns the sign around and starts writing. While she's doing that, this blind man feels her shoes so he can recognize who this is later on. She puts the sign down and walks off, doesn't leave any money. Very quickly, you see many people dropping coins, multiple coins, and all of a sudden, there's a transformation has occurred. Sometime later, this fast-paced executive businesswoman comes walking past and stops in front, and he hears the high heels coming towards him, and he recognizes him, and he feels the shoes, and then you hear him say, "What did you do to my sign?" Like he's intrigued. See, he knows that she did something, but he doesn't know what it was. And to that question, she says, "I wrote the same thing, but just in different words." She puts her hand on his shoulder, squeezes it, and walks off without giving him any money. And then as the camera pans on the sign, you see the words, "It's a beautiful day, and I can't see it." You see the power of words, and it's one thing to be made aware of a problem. It's a whole other thing. It's altogether something different to be moved to take action. And that's what we need. Information is critical. Information is important. We need to be made aware of our risk. And we're seeking to do that today. I'm seeking to bring together what I feel some of the most important information is that makes us aware of our personal risk. But more important than that is that somehow we can be moved to take action. That's the critical thing. And so as we spend the next 45 minutes going over this together, I encourage you to take some notes so that you can stay aware. But more importantly, I want you to be thinking, what is it that I'm going to do with this information? How am I going to move forward? Will it make a difference in my health? So what is then the single most important risk factor? It's not the traditional risk factors that we've been focusing on. In fact, it's somewhat of a difficult concept to understand initially because it's called insulin resistance. Now, for those of you that are either my patients or you've been coming to dinner with a doctor over the last 7 months, you've heard us talk about this a lot. And maybe you're starting to get a better appreciation to what it means to have for the muscle and the liver and the cell, the organs of our body to be resistant to the effect of insulin. Because see, when the body becomes resistant to this hormone that's made by the pancreas, it increases the risk for all kinds of problems. And according to Dr. David Eddy's mathematical model, 42% of all cardiovascular disease, in fact, all heart attacks, both fatal and non-fatal, could be prevented if insulin resistance were to be properly diagnosed early on in somebody's life, in their early adulthood, and then properly, effectively managed over time for their entire life. It's the number one factor. More important than cholesterol, more important than blood pressure, more important than the good cholesterol, more important than anything else. So let's try to paint a quick picture of what this is. Practically speaking, when the muscle has all the sugar in it that it needs, it is not going to be more receptive to the effect of insulin to store more sugar from the blood into the cells, right? Okay, so if the muscle has lots of sugar in it, why would it be receptive to the hormones that are supposed to store sugar from the blood into the muscle or to the liver cells? And in doing so, because they are in need of no additional sugar, they're in need of nothing, they become resistant to the effects of what the body needs to do to be healthy. As long as they have what they need, the cells don't care what's happening elsewhere. But the organ systems of the body do care because they're responsible for the entire system. And so the pancreas notices that the sugar is starting to build up in the blood. That's not good. The sugar, as it builds up, it'll stick to the tissues. It'll stick to the organs. It'll cause damage to the eyes and to the kidneys. And everywhere it sticks, it causes damage. And so quickly, the pancreas, as a regulator of this, says, I need to make more what? I need to make more insulin. And so as soon as we have a resistance in the muscle and the liver cells to insulin, the pancreas has to now make more insulin, even though you have plenty of insulin floating around. And so now we have essentially, by our choices, forced the pancreas to make abnormally high levels of insulin. And that is an independent risk factor for many of our current problems. Essentially, it's what I call serendipitous synergy. That's a tongue twister. Serendipitous synergy. Many times I'll have a patient come in and they have a certain goal in mind, and that's wonderful. Without goals, we wouldn't be seeking any help at all, right? So it's important to have a goal, at least in mind. But many times that goal is actually not anywhere near in the priorities that I would pick for that person once I actually have more information. But the beautiful thing about lifestyle change, the beautiful thing about choosing natural methods to improve our health, is that it doesn't just impact that risk factor, the one that we're choosing. It does not only focus on whatever it is that we're working on, whether it's improving our cholesterol or our blood sugar or losing weight or addressing cancer or stimulating the immune system, fixing whatever we're trying to fix. When we choose lifestyle strategies, and inherently by that I mean that we're looking at more than one approach. We're not just exercising. We're not just addressing diet. We're not just taking time to be outside in the sunlight and getting fresh air and sleeping appropriately and so forth, but we're trying to embrace all the strategies that make sense, that are prudent for us to participate in. And now, because of that, while we're actually improving the area that we're focusing on, many times without knowing it, we are having a much more powerful influence on something that we haven't recognized as a risk factor yet. I've had patients whose main goal was to just lower their cholesterol, and without realizing it, we found out that something else was wrong, and when we fixed that, it inadvertently, actually that's not a correct term, it serendipitously also fixed a much more serious condition that could have taken that person's life within a few years if we hadn't found it. Okay, and all that came about because of the willingness to take on a natural strategy, help benefit one area that now serendipitously is benefiting everything that we're at risk for, even those things that we may never, ever recognize or understand. So if we make good decisions for our heart, right? That's what we're here to understand. If we follow the good advice that's available right now in the medical literature to support prevention and treatment and reversal of heart disease, then other good things happen. In fact, if we take the time to understand this risk, this number one risk factor for cardiovascular disease, which is this metabolic syndrome or insulin resistance, at the same time as we're lowering our risk of heart disease, we are dramatically impacting our body's ability to prevent and manage cancer. It's powerful. Because when the body starts being resistant, it's a form of compartmentalized rebellion. Have you ever felt rebellious? I certainly have, where you should do something because it's the right thing to do, but you just, there's something about us that we just really rebel against that. Well, that's what goes on in the body all the time. And so when the cells are rebelling and saying, we are not going to address this, oftentimes the rebellion comes because of a reason. In an insulin resistance, that muscle and liver system rebellion comes because we are not adequately controlling the fats and the sugars inside the cells. What would be a reason, a rational explanation as to why the muscle cell has all the sugar that it needs? because we maybe haven't taken the time to use up that sugar inside of the muscle cell. And how do we use up the sugar in the muscle cell? Yes, it's through exercise. And so another strategy, okay, that, and we're going to be talking about a lot of things at the same time here, so hold on. A critical strategy that we all inherently understand is that daily exercise dramatically alters pretty much all the risk factors for heart disease and cancer and neurologic disease and enhances the immune system. And so there's a broad benefit from exercise. Dr. Paffenbarger, he's a physician and a PhD researcher out of Harvard and then Stanford, was the leader of the studies out of Harvard showing that individuals who exercise an average of a half an hour a day, just moderate exercise, lowered their risk of a heart attack, fatal or non-fatal, by 50%. So right there, this is critical. And again, we all understand that exercise is important. We've been hearing about that most of our lives. But it's critical to recognize that just scheduling, taking the time to prioritize exercise in our busy, fast-paced Southern California lifestyle, if we make sure that it happens most every day of our lives, that in of itself will lower our risk by 50%. And then one of the main reasons for that is because it is improving the way the muscle and the liver relate to the rest of the body, and so now there's not a reason for discontent. Now there's not a reason for discord and rebellion between the organ systems in our body. So one of the key things that we need to remember to have good health is to remove the natural barriers and challenges that cause dysfunction, discord, discontent between the different systems of the body. They have to work in concert. They have to support each other. And so when we don't exercise on a daily basis, the muscle and the liver can't properly support the rest of the system. And so we are much more likely to succumb to disease. Well, how do avocados influence all this? That's what you've been wanting to find out. Avocados represent what we call healthy fats. They are heart-healthy fats, and they are fats that damage the heart. So there's fats that heal and fats that kill. Fats that help reverse disease and fats that cause initiation and promotion of disease. So let's talk about these things. One of the very interesting things about avocados is that if you take any time to research avocados, for more than 10 years, studies have been coming out showing that the fats and the other nutrients found in avocados and soybeans, when brought together, have a powerful influence on reducing inflammation in the body. Has anti-inflammatory benefits. And researchers are suggesting that part of that benefit is coming from a class of nutrients, of plant-based chemicals called the unsaponifiables. Sounds like a new movie, doesn't it? The unsaponifiables. In fact, a journal called Arthritis and Rheumatology published a study showing that when this is used in moderation on a regular basis, it can have a significant impact on arthritis because it's such a powerful anti-inflammatory. Osteoarthritis of the knees, of the fingers and other joints in the body can be influenced in the right direction by just taking advantage of healthy fats that are also in context with whole food. See, so this is the benefit of looking at whole plant-based foods largely consumed on a daily basis. Because we're not just taking the fat out of the avocado, we're consuming also the other plant-based chemicals, most of which are not nutrients, by the way. See, there's nutrients in food that are critical to our health, but in many cases, more importantly, it's all the other chemicals that are not nutrients, but they have an influence on how the genes work. We've talked about this before, so I won't focus on that tonight, but essentially, when we consume these whole foods in moderation and in balance, we bring in these chemicals that are not found anywhere else. You can't get them in medicines, and you can't even get them in supplements many times because we don't even understand them yet fully. But they can dramatically alter risk. In fact, so the healthy fats would include, the healthy fats in avocados would increase the HDL. And by the way, the studies are now showing that the HDL cholesterol, the healthy cholesterol that is actually part of the reverse cholesterol transport system that actually helps remove plaque out of the artery walls and dumps that plaque in the liver, and then the liver can break that down. And as long as we have plenty of fiber in our diet, then the liver can get rid of that toxic cholesterol. The fiber attaches to it, and it's removed from the body with the next bowel movement. That's the only way we can get rid of bad cholesterol, through a healthy diet that's high in fiber, but also through a diet that promotes the production of the healthy cholesterol and the healthy fats in particular, like avocado fat, like extra virgin olive oil or the olive itself, are powerful in increasing the healthy cholesterol. Now, what's interesting, see, we're talking about serendipity here, that the very same molecules in those foods that increase the HDL also reverse insulin resistance and can correct this elevation in blood sugar and insulin that for up to 20% of Americans over their lifetime will lead to diabetes. Up to 50% or more of even young adults and middle-aged individuals will develop pre-diabetes because of this insulin resistance problem. So this is a huge issue. And daily exercise, followed with proper meal balancing strategies and using healthy fats, healthy proteins, and high-fiber starches together at each meal can be powerful. Okay, what about the other benefits of avocados? Lowers blood sugars, as we discussed. It's anti-inflammatory. It's anti-cancer because not only does it have nutrients and chemicals in it that turn off the cancer genes. See, we have over 400 genes that we know of in our bodies that, if turned on, causes cancer. Kind of scary that we all carry genes in our body that if that gene gets turned on, we get cancer, or our risk goes up substantially. The good news, though, is that we can actually turn off those genes. How do we do that? Well, we do that by taking advantage of the entire armamentarium, which includes the proper foods that have those chemicals that can help shut that switch down, turn that switch down, squelch it down to next to no influence. And researchers are suggesting now that we can actually turn them off completely. So let's review the healthy fats in addition to avocados. Nuts, especially raw nuts, which means that they'll have all those nutrients and phyto plant-based chemicals. They'll have all that magnesium, that fiber. They have the zinc and other nutrients in them that you're not going to get as effectively from other foods. Nuts are a powerhouse of nutrition. And so that's why most of us would benefit by eating a handful of nuts every day, especially with breakfast, because it helps balance the healthy carbohydrates with healthy fats and proteins and stabilize the blood sugar for the rest of the morning so that we don't give in to having that cookie or that donut halfway through the morning or an hour before lunch, because the brain is now starved of sugar. And if the brain's not working, if the brain's not focusing, what do? Okay, it's easy to succumb to something that really isn't that good for us. We know it's not good for us, but somehow we feel so much better, we do it anyways, right? Because if we don't feel well, we're going to find a way to feel well or feel better, even if it's not good for us. That's an unfortunate part of being human, is that we have become very effective and efficient at trading off, okay, trading away health just to feel better. It might only last for 5 minutes. Maybe it'll last for an hour or two or a day. But in the end, we are trading away our health. So what we want to do is find methods where we actually get both. We are able to feel better and be healthy at the same time. And so it's critical that we understand the benefits of meal balancing in order to do that. So many times somebody says, oh, I had a great breakfast today. I had Cheerios and a half an apple. Well, there's not a lot of bad things you can say about Cheerios and a half an apple. The problem is it's not balanced. And since at least half of us are very prone to insulin resistance, which means our blood sugars will start spiking, the body makes more insulin, and that insulin is going to drive our genetic risk, because it's turning on the genes now, remember, for cancers. It's going to turn on the genes for high blood pressure. It's going to turn on the genes for whatever it might be that we are genetically susceptible to. And so we have to, that's why that handful of nuts there would dramatically improve that meal. Okay? Having actually the old-fashioned oatmeal, a cooked cereal of some kind, would dramatically increase the nutritional benefit of that meal as well. And so it's not just avoiding the bad that we're looking at, but what can we do to transform, to dramatically enhance the nutritional value of every meal that we consume? So bringing in raw nuts can be powerful. Seeds, flax seeds, chia seeds are kind of the rage now. One reason is you don't have to grind them up. Okay, the little black seeds that have at least as much healthy fiber in them as flax do, but more importantly, they are a powerful antioxidant. They don't need to be ground up. You can just chew them up. You add them to salad. They're very high in omega-3s, just like flax. They're high in protein as well. So that's another thing that can be added simply to the diet, something that's whole and natural. Olives, we mentioned. And then coconut. The coconut flesh can be added in different ways. Or even the extra virgin, the organic coconut oil can be added to the diet. If we have time, we're going to spend a few minutes on showing how coconut oil can dramatically influence neurologic conditions. Coconut oil is a medium-chain fatty acid. It's totally saturated, but it's medium-chain. It's not like other saturated fats that clearly increase the internal production of cholesterol in the body. In fact, the coconut oil has a special fat in it called lauric acid that is a very powerful antimicrobial, antifungal. Now, what did I say at the very beginning? Heart disease is no longer a condition that is just caused by factors that cannot be communicated, that are not infectious. Heart disease is very much being influenced by subtle infectious disease. And this lauric acid in coconut oil is a very powerful element that day by day can keep subtle infections at bay and controlled. So that's one of the values. And that is one of the reasons that it is now being considered to be neuroprotective. It protects the brain and protects the nerves. Why? Because now we're recognizing that subtle infections are driving many neurologic conditions like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. There are old class antibiotics that are fat soluble that are now being promoted as a neuroprotective agent. You can look it up. So, all the more reason why we should be taking advantage of broad strategies with the diet and other approaches that can help the body's immune system become much more powerful at eradicating, not just keeping things at bay, but eradicating infections that may have been present in our body for decades. Well, so many things that we could look at. So, 42% of all cardiovascular events could be prevented if we just pay attention to controlling our metabolism, the insulin levels in our body. Let me give you one more strategy to improve insulin before we move on. We've talked about meal balancing strategies that keep the blood sugar stable all day long. That's really critical to the process. Secondarily, exercising on a daily basis, we've established, is critical. But the best form of exercise, and many of you have heard me say this many times, is exercise at what time of the day? After you eat. We had to think about that because it's still not fully ingrained, is it? If light to moderate exercise immediately after meals actually can prevent the blood sugar spikes that occur in at least 50% of us. I'm not talking about those of us who have diabetes or even pre-diabetes. I'm suggesting that at least half of us, probably 75% of us, will have blood sugar spikes right after meals. That's not good. That damages the system. And so by balancing the meals and then getting outside, walking around, even up to a brisk walk, even if it's just 5 minutes, but preferably 10 or 15 minutes after most meals, that light to moderate exercise can totally negate the blood sugar spike that we would otherwise have. And if we're going to prevent disease, do we wait until the blood sugar gets up to its very top point about an hour after the meal and then say, ooh, I should go out and exercise because my blood sugar's high? No, once the blood sugar spikes, it's already caused significant damage to the system. Now, it's never too late to do something healthy. Okay? But wouldn't we rather actually completely prevent that abnormal blood sugar spike by getting to exercise at the right time? This is the whole field of chronobiology that we've discussed previously. That timing is everything. Doing things at the right time can make the difference between 100% effectiveness and minimal effectiveness. So consider that light activity, especially after the larger meals of the day, as being very, very beneficial. Okay, the second most important risk factor to pay attention to based on these new studies after insulin resistance is elevated blood pressure. 36% of all heart attacks could be prevented if we properly diagnosed and managed blood pressure from somebody's young adulthood. Okay, so that we're doing a pretty good job of evaluating that. Nobody gets out of the doctor's office without getting that cuff put on and checking the blood pressure. And that's a good thing because we want to track what's going on with the blood pressure. Now, the problem, though, is that although we have been extremely effective in diagnosing high blood pressure, we have done a horrible job at managing high blood pressure. Any nephrologist, kidney specialist, would tell you that we have lost the war on hypertension. So much so that the current guidelines for managing high blood pressure suggest that you have to, on average, be on 3 to 4 different medications if you even hope to get your blood pressure under control. Now, not too long ago, I was at a small conference in a medical group, a large medical group, where a specialist had come in, a nephrologist had come in to speak. And he said this. He says, don't even suggest to your patient that they're going to be able to control their blood pressure when you put them on that medicine, because it's not going to work. So we were like, in fact, even two medicines isn't going to work for most people. The studies now show that you have to have them on 3 to 4 medicines before you are actually controlling the blood sugars, according to blood pressures, rather, according to guidelines. And then he said with a kind of a tongue-in-cheek, he says, unless your patient gets religion in the form of lifestyle medicine. So he recognized the studies that show that if somebody starts looking at these broader strategies, these natural strategies, that most of them can control their blood pressures without even one medication. But recognizing human nature, they're suggesting, let's just keep pushing the medications. Now, here's the problem. It says, while the medications have been shown to lower the events of strokes, I think the data is pretty clear about that, it's important to understand that the high blood pressure didn't occur because of the absence of the blood pressure medication. Something else was causing it. And so what we should always be doing, whether we're clinicians or patients, is ask the question, what actually caused the blood pressure, in this case, to be high in the first place? What are the multiple causes of this? Now, Dr. Gerald Reaven, a renowned endocrinologist from Stanford University, he's published hundreds and hundreds of studies. He was chairman of endocrinology at Stanford for many decades. He's actually lectured at Loma Linda University several times, and I had a rare opportunity when he was in between lectures. I actually got to talk to him for 2 hours. That was only once. But he has shown in his research and other research that up to 80% of all essential hypertension is caused by insulin resistance. So we come back to number one. In other words, the main driver of essential hypertension, what does that mean, by the way? It means that the actual cause of the problem hasn't been addressed yet or hasn't been determined yet. So it's just called, this is high blood pressure, we're going to treat it with these medicines, but we don't really know the real cause of the problem. Or we haven't taken the time to figure out for you what the actual cause of the problem is. And so based on the evidence in front of us, what's the first thing that we should address if somebody has high blood pressure? Addressing insulin resistance. So let me back up and give you a laboratory test, okay? Because I want to give you some practical information here as we're wrapping up the most important, most critical risk factors. In my opinion, one of the best tests for somebody who's had elevated pressure and the other typical things that have been done haven't been working is to, along with other things we're going to be talking about, is actually measure the body's response to sugar. Right? Because if Dr. Gerald Reaven has done legitimate research, and he's a lot smarter than I ever will be, a brilliant man, okay? I want to put some stock into what he says. If he says up to 80% of all high blood pressure is caused by this problem, then I want to make sure that I'm addressing that problem with my patient. And so how do we evaluate insulin resistance? The very best way I'm aware of is that you test a body's response to sugar. And it's a very simple test. It's available. It's called the glucose tolerance test. It's typically reserved for evaluating whether or not somebody has diabetes. But it's far, far more valuable than just picking up early diabetes, which it does better than any other test, by the way. Far better than a fasting blood sugar. Far better than even a what we call a hemoglobin A1C blood test, which measures how sticky the blood, how much sugar is sticking to cells in the body. So we have that patient get the fasting blood sugar drawn, and then, and the fasting insulin, how much insulin the pancreas is making at baseline, before a meal, and then we give them a sweet drink in the lab. If they don't want that sweet drink in the lab, because for some reason they say, oh, I don't want to do that, then I just tell them to go get some pancakes and come back in an hour, and we'll check your blood again. This is essentially the same test. And so we check the blood sugars again at 1 hour and at 2 hours after that sugar drink or sweet meal, carbohydrate-rich meal. And we also check the insulin again at 2 hours to see, now is the pancreas having to make lots of insulin to compensate? And if it is, we know that that is a significant contributor to all kinds of things, right? The serendipitous effect is cancer risk is going to be going up. So whatever individual risk they already carry, for whatever reason, for cancer, that's going to be heightened. Whatever individual risk they have for high blood pressure, that's going to be heightened. Whatever the genetic tendencies are will be increased, will be augmented because of that factor. So that two-hour glucose tolerance test, I think, is one of the best things to that. Now, not everybody with high blood pressure is going to have that problem, but we would expect that at least half would. Based on the research, at least half would. So it's a wonderful way to help drive strategies that make a difference. Another critical factor that influences blood pressure is just looking at how much potassium and magnesium there is in our diet. Not too long ago, a major study was published that caused shockwaves to go through the medical and the public health community. It was a study that showed, using the same strategies, the same statistical methods that were used to determine that smoking caused cancer, it's the same methods, showed that if we could just decrease the salt in the American diet by about a third, which is still maybe not enough according to some recommendations, we could save 90+ thousand lives a year just from that alone. And but what really got some people upset was that they said that the salt in the American diet was a greater risk factor than smoking. That's essentially what the study suggested. Okay. But newer studies have actually shed some new light suggesting that simply cutting salt out of the American diet really isn't the issue. The issue is that we need to increase the potassium, dramatically increase the potassium in the American diet. It's the salt to potassium ratio that's really the key, just like in cholesterol language, it's the ratio between the good and the bad that's really the key. So what do we do to increase potassium? Whole plant-based foods. 100% whole grains. 100% lots of green leafy vegetables, legumes, beans, peas, and lentils. Not only are loaded with potassium, but they're also loaded with all the other things that we need. And all the magnesium that we need. Studies out of Harvard showed that if you have high cholesterol, that cholesterol will tend to fill in the plaques and cause atherosclerosis. Unless they discovered magnesium was at an optimal level in the blood. Magnesium somehow had this ability to neutralize the effect of cholesterol in forming the plaque. Okay, so rather than focusing all our attention on lowering the cholesterol, maybe what we should be doing is focusing our attention on increasing the elements, the missing ingredients in our body that are so critical to lowering our risk from the things that are already there. So the two key strategies that we have available to us is remove the offending elements, but make sure that we're optimizing the things that are available to us that our body is designed, is created to use to protect itself. And magnesium is a great example of that. And then there's been some amazing research on vitamin D. So if you haven't had your vitamin D checked, see, I am human just like anybody else, and since I've been talking until I'm blue in the face about vitamin D for the last 10 years, I'm assuming everybody knows about this, right? In fact, I sometimes apologize for bringing it up because, yeah, you got to know about this. Everybody knows about this, right? Well, no. There are millions and millions of people that have no idea how important vitamin D is. And part of it is because there's not a really good consensus in the medical community. You got studies saying one thing, and then you got Institute of Medicine saying something else. So there's all this differing opinions in the literature, in the newspaper. And so pretty soon we just say, I'll wait until they figure it out. Well, guess what? They're never going to figure it out. There's always going to be contention on all these things, okay? We need to start making decisions on what is prudent, what seems prudent to us based on the medical evidence. Now, in terms of looking at the issue of vitamin D, Dr. William Castelli, who for many years was the director of the Framingham Heart Study, it was probably the best medical study ever done, and it's still ongoing, where they took an entire community of Framingham, Massachusetts, and every family in that community is being evaluated every 2 years. So now we're into multi-generations of every 2 years, full physical, full evaluation, all the blood work and everything is frozen, and so we can go back to 1940s and look at blood samples and find out stuff that we otherwise could never determine. And they discovered, and out of their data, that if you have a vitamin D level less than 15, which isn't all that atypical, okay, I see so many people with a vitamin D less than 15 here in Southern California, that their risk of heart disease automatically goes up twofold. And the power of vitamin D, talk about synergy. We could talk for 10 hours about the value of vitamin D and protecting against cancer. A study just came out, two studies over the last year have shown that breast cancer patients who have terminal breast cancer can dramatically extend their lifespan. They live at least twice as long as those who have lower levels of vitamin D. For those who have high levels of vitamin D in their blood, it dramatically expands their lifespan. And that's just one thing. You know, we don't just stop with that, give them the vitamin D and say good luck. We look at all the strategies, right? That's just one strategy, how powerful that can be. Researchers, in fact, the doctors James O'Keefe, who's a cardiologist and the director of preventive cardiology at the Kansas City Heart Institute, he has gone on record. He's taken a stand. He says, vitamin D is one of the most unrecognized cardiovascular risk factors, and it should be screened in everybody and treated in everybody, and the methods, the treatments are simple, they're safe, and they're effective. And yet so many people haven't taken the time to get their vitamin D checked. Don't just start taking vitamin D without checking your blood, because then you'll never know what you really were. You'll never know what your risk was. And because of our natural human tendencies, after we do something for a month or two, then we get a little lackadaisical, don't we? Because why? Because we didn't really understand the risk to begin with. Okay, and so we lose that motivation because it's, well, you know, I take it once in a while. I'm okay. I got some sun today. Beautiful day. I got at least 10 minutes of sun. I got all the vitamin D I needed. I used to have that opinion until I actually measured my vitamin D 10 years ago. and I was low. Right? So don't assume that you're good because you like to be outside. Because if I was a betting man and you were willing to bet with me, I'd make a lot of money in this room. Okay, yeah, on how many people have low, very low vitamin D levels. Get tested and then get that managed properly. Study that just came out looking at the African-American population, and they gave 60,000 units once every 4 weeks for 4 months. So that's, you know, that's about six times more than some people take every day. So it seems like a whole lot, but guess what? It dramatically altered the blood pressure in these African Americans. Because, see, a low level of vitamin D causes your kidney to not manufacture, not balance the hormones, the renin, angiotensin, aldosterone system that regulates blood pressure for a lot of people. And if we have an inadequacy of a given nutrient in our body, now all these intricately created systems can't do their job. And then we chalk it up to, it's essential hypertension. We have no idea why it's high. Well, we don't have to be brilliant diagnosticians to improve our health. All we need to do is start paying attention to all these things that are well documented to influence. Make sure that you're not deficient. Make sure that you're not minimizing the opportunity to take in the things that the body needs. Well, there's so many things that we could address. I hope that today we have touched on some things that maybe have encouraged some of you to redirect a little bit. Let's review some of the things that we've looked at. If you have a concern about cardiovascular disease, maybe it's because of family history. Maybe your main motivation is because your father or mother or sibling have succumbed to it. And you might have this idea that, what can I do about this? It's like, it's happened to so many people in my family that I really can't expect to get out of this risk. But do you know what the actual contribution of family history is to our real cardiovascular risk? According to Dr. David Eddy's recent studies, it was the lowest contributor of all the established causal risk factors. The lowest contributor. So low that only 4% of all heart attacks, fatal or non-fatal, could be attributed to family history. Now, don't misunderstand. I'm not suggesting completely ignore the fact that you have had a family history of heart disease. Use that information to find out what your true risk is by getting the appropriate test and evaluation and then managing it well. I pay attention to cardiovascular risk because my grandfather died of a massive heart attack the year before I was born. That's important to me. I didn't recognize that somehow that related to me. But when my uncle, who was working as an ER physician in a Dallas, Texas hospital, in his 50s, died of a massive heart attack in the ER that he was working in, I started to ask the question, does this somehow relate to me? Should I be starting to evaluate my risk and look at my specific risk factors and then start to do something about them? So let's look at some of these tests that we can take. The glucose tolerance test. With a fasting 1 hour and 2 hour blood sugar, including a fasting and 2 hour insulin. Those are not standard tests, by the way. That's why I'm being very deliberate and specific and outlining that to you. valuable test. Why? Because that represents the most important risk factor for cardiovascular disease and our opportunity to reverse that condition or prevent it from ever occurring. Number two, the cholesterol profile that I would encourage you to test is called the VAP cholesterol profile. Just all caps, VAP. Don't ask me what that stands for. It's one of those things in medicine that doesn't really mean anything other than directing us to a test that looks at not just how much cholesterol we have, but whether that cholesterol is small and dense and more likely to infiltrate the artery wall. That it represents a part of the insulin resistance that we've been talking about. So it's a more detailed cholesterol profile that gives us better clues about insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome. Another test that I'd highly recommend, and maybe during the question and answer period, we'll discuss this briefly, but being more intentional of evaluating thyroid, evaluating the thyroid-stimulating hormone. Studies have, the early studies that first caused physicians to be concerned about how cholesterol increased the risk of heart disease. It's because the studies done on rabbits showed when you fed rabbits cholesterol, they developed plaque in their arteries. And that's what led to the big campaign to reduce cholesterol. But how many of us have heard the studies that the same researchers did over the next few years when they made sure that those rabbits had plenty of iodine, when they gave them the same high levels of cholesterol dietarily, none of them developed the plaque? Are you getting the picture? Okay. That it's really more important to make sure that you have the right nutritional elements in your body. Make sure that before you start stripping away all the bad, what we think are the bad things, make sure that you're first giving yourself the things that the body needs. The foods that are rich in magnesium, the foods that are rich in potassium, the foods that are rich in fiber, the foods that have unrecognized thousands upon thousands of chemicals that we don't even understand yet to have the potential to alter genetic expression. Iodine is deficiency is rampant, even though we don't think it is anymore because we've solved the goiter problem for most people. But in fact, most people have inadequate amounts of iodine in their diet as well. So that's something that we could discuss at another time. So the key here is making sure that we take the time. If we understand or are beginning to understand our risk for the number one killer in the United States, it would be worth taking a little bit more time to evaluate with appropriate tests and then use these natural strategies to control them. And according to the studies done by Dr. David Eddy, if we manage them well year after year for the rest of our lives, we can lower our risk of heart disease by well over than 50%. See, if we have insulin resistance, our risk of a heart attack goes up 300%. But we can remove more than half of that risk by just managing that one risk factor effectively. But don't stop with one. Take the time to evaluate all the risk factors, as many as you can, and then develop a program that gives serendipitous synergy. Thank you for your time. Let's end with a quick word of prayer. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Father, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to just take an hour and just evaluate our personal risk. You have watched so much disease and disability occur, and we know it saddens you. I just pray, Lord, that you give us wisdom individually within our families to properly evaluate our risk. And then once we've established, once we better understand and we're aware of what the risk is, to have the willingness to take action, to do something about it, to start more effectively following these strategies, many of which we already know to be true, but we're holding on to them and being consistent with them. So thank you for your love that you share with us. And we pray today that you give us the determination to achieve the serendipity that we've been discussing today. And we thank you in Christ's name. Amen.